Welcome to the Rhone Podcast. Rhone is a curated physicians network that supports concierge, DPC, and private practices so they can remain independent without being alone. We believe that the future success of primary care requires membership-based medicine practices to thrive. Hello, I'm Dr. Scott Pope, CEO of Rhone, and I'm glad you found us. I hope you enjoy this latest episode of the Rhone Podcast. Welcome back, everyone, to the Rhone Podcast. We've got another great episode for you today. We're going to dive into a topic called proteomics. Many of us may be very familiar with the idea of precision medicine and a very evolving field that helps in diagnostics, really getting into very patient-specific parameters to identify disease progression, their susceptibility to different types of drugs, et cetera. Well, proteomics is a kind of an evolution downstream from that. Now, we've got an excellent guest with us today, Dr. Roy Smyth, CEO of SomaLogic. Dr. Smyth, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Scott. And please call me Roy.
Excellent. I will do it. Thank you, Roy. So with the topic of proteomics, I couldn't think of a better presenter to be on with us today, a better guest than yourself. Tell us a little bit about some of your background and how you've your personal journey getting into the proteomic space.
Sure. I started out my professional life as a physician. I was one of those perpetual trainees. So I trained in general surgery, surgical oncology, cardiothoracic surgery, and did a postdoc in molecular therapeutics. My career started out as a sort of a practicing physician scientist. I tended to operate 5 days a week and then run my lab group, in between those cases sort of thing. So I was at MD Anderson for a number of years. Then I was a medical school department chair for about a decade. And then my last couple of years inside of healthcare proper, I was a chief innovation officer. But back during medical school, I did a fellowship at Wharton in healthcare economics, one that the faculty back then, this is in the mid-80s, and Scott, and the faculty in the mid-80s at Wharton was a Dana Scholar, was a thing called a Dana Scholars Program, were saying that healthcare needed to change, the structure of delivery needed to change, investments were being made in the wrong things, people were making bad decisions. Of course, I thought they were crazy my first few weeks there. I was a kid that had grown up wanting to be a doctor since I was 7 years old. And by the time I left there, I said, I think those guys are right. And then, during my career, I saw basically everything they said was going to happen happening around me. At times I felt like that kid in the movie where he was the only one seeing dead people.
Oh, yeah.
And so, The Sixth Sense. And so I decided, sort of late in beyond the midpoint of my medical career, to shift to the business side, frankly, because I thought that there was a bigger impact to be made if you could find the right, types of products and services and solutions to harness, your reins to.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you on today. This topic of proteomics, I think, is one that has gotten a lot more buzz. There's so much new coming around in the diagnostics domain, and this proteomics is one that I think a lot of us that trained back in the 80s and 90s, proteomics wasn't even a word that we used.
That's right, it wasn't.
Right, and certainly not something that we were taught. So. I'm thrilled to have you on today to enlighten us a little bit. So I'm more familiar with the concept of precision medicine. It's also a relatively new term, but it's focused more on kind of the DNA makeup of an individual. How does proteomics differ from precision medicine, or is it a component of precision medicine in your opinion?
Well, I believe it'll be an exceptionally large component of precision medicine moving forward. If you think about it, the word precision, or to be precise, would entrain a number of different thoughts, including that you would want to be predicting things in real time, and you know, being able to impact diseases as they were progressing in real time. And so I believe that proteomics will have a huge impact on that. You know, genomics has, and it's funny, you said we weren't talking about proteomics in the 80s or 90s. And I think people have just sort of gotten used to uttering the word genomics in the last few years, especially practitioners. And, but you know, genomics has made a huge impact unequivocally on healthcare and on medicine. The only problem is that it's a relatively narrow band of things that genomics appears to be, you know, really informative for. In other words, we know that oncologic diseases, that genomics is incredibly important. And that's because tumor cells' genomes don't behave like our germline genomes do, and they change constantly. And so those changes can be predictive of things like prognosis and what drugs you need to select to have, give a patient their best chance of beating it. And then, you know, it sort of bleeds over into a few other areas for sure, but you know, genomics can't tell you a lot about what's going on in real time. Only about 5 to 7% of human diseases are driven by dominant changes in genomics. And the rest of human disease is dependent on some sort of genomic predisposition and exposures that happen in real time, or exposures alone. And what proteomics does is gives you a window into all of that potentially. And you know, that's what precision medicine is all about. It shouldn't be limited to a handful of diseases. It shouldn't be limited to lifetime risk. It should be informing you about what the patient's problems are in real time and helping you understand what you might do to, you know, change the trajectory of a person's disease process.
And so, Roy, just so I'm sure that I've got this right. So as I hearken back to some of my training back in the 90s, so when I think about, you know, the genetic profile of a person's DNA, and you carry forward then a genetic code that's in the messenger RNA that then codes for different type of proteins, and the DNA makeup of an individual is rather static, right? But on the protein side, and I appreciate you letting me go down to kind of a fourth grade level here to simplify things a bit, but that those proteins are ever evolving and ever changing on a regular basis. And so that the comment that you made there, that while the genetic makeup may be stationary, the downstream results, that is the proteins and is the study of those proteins, proteomics, is really where you see this kind of almost mushroom cloud of research and impact in patient care coming from. Do I have all that correct?
You do. And you know, so that's the rub here, that the genetic material is the template. And some of that template can predict things over the entire course of your life. So if you're a woman that has a mutation in the BRCA1 gene, we know that during the course of your life that you're really at high risk for, you know, certain types of malignancies. But the number of those genes that predict things during the course of your life, or at least the number of individuals that have those mutations, is very real, but not huge. And again, there are all sorts of diseases where those mutations don't drive what's going to happen. It's what's happening in your body in real time. So the genes are static. That's right. There's some stuff called epigenetics. There are some changes in genes that the environment and exposures can cause, but they don't tend to be sort of broad enough to be all that impactful. And then you're right. Genes make messenger RNA, and you could say, well, let's just study that messenger RNA because the genes are reacting to the environment and the messenger RNA is gene expression. And that's correct. The problem with messenger RNA is that it only translates about 50% of the time into the proteins that are, you know, downstream of that messenger RNA. So DNA makes messenger RNA makes proteins. And proteins are the structural and functional molecules of life. When you're measuring someone's blood pressure with a blood pressure cuff, you're measuring proteins, hormones, enzymes, the proteins that are working in the wall of the blood vessel. And all of those things are happening in real time. Your proteome turns over, or the proteins in your body, And there are 20,000 basic protein structures in your body. And we can get at this if you want, but that's that 20,000 proteins, all different sizes, all different shapes, all over your body, all different half-lives, you know, the lifespan of each one of those proteins has been what's made it so difficult to harness proteomics as a tool compared to DNA. You always know where to find it, only four base pairs. As it turns out, relatively easy to measure. Proteins have been a real challenge, but your proteome, that all those proteins in your body turn over about 40,000 times during your life. And the information that's being transmitted from proteins going up and down over time is real-time biology. And real-time biology is real-time medicine. So that's the difference, I think, between DNA, RNA, and proteins, and why proteins offer this incredibly powerful platform or proteomics to tell us things we've never been able to get at before. We've gotten at, you know, with a lot of indirect diagnostic methodologies, some of which are, you know, more accurate than others.
So that's absolutely fascinating. I'm so enamored by this whole concept. So as some of these, I think about the half-lives of these different proteins, what are some of the areas where proteomics is starting to get a foothold in kind of real world patient care?
Well, it's just beginning to get a foothold for sure. And we've been doing quote unquote proteomics for 150 years, really, just not at scale. So, you know, when a patient goes into a physician's office and gets an SMA 20 test run on their blood, there's a number of single protein tests on that panel, right? So creatinine, blood urea nitrogen, hemoglobin, those are all single protein tests. So we've been measuring single proteins for 150 years. And then over the last, I would say, 20 years, there's been an effort to sort of look at the medical literature and say, I think these four or five proteins are important in this disease because they tend to crop up in the medical literature over and over again as biomarkers. Let's try to fit them together in some sort of an algorithm that can predict something. And so we've been trying that for 20 years, but the approach that we take is dramatically different. The way that we create these diagnostic tests that have between 16 and 360 proteins in them. And so, as I mentioned earlier, there's really no disease process that we can't potentially have a window into. What we focused on initially at SomaLogic, our first sort of tranche of high-plex proteomic diagnostics has been metabolic and cardiovascular diseases. And we're just now working with healthcare providers. Some of the members of your organization are using these in a demonstration market. And we've announced a project with several large health systems to have them, you know, touch and see and feel and work with these new class of diagnostics so that they can understand what the impact could be.
Excellent. The yes, there's a number of the Roamed member physicians that have been using some of the proteomics tests, and actually at the Roamed annual meeting in October, we're going to have a presentation on some of that firsthand experience at the event as well. So it's really nice that we get to have this episode to kind of get into some of the nitty gritty on the proteomic side. So talk to me a little bit about, from my pharmacist days, this idea of, you know, pharmaceutical companies creating new drugs and needing a companion diagnostic test. Is that an area we can expect to see kind of an explosion in proteomics as well as in that companion diagnostic space? Or is there maybe some stuff already there?
Sure. Well, if you think about a test like, let's say, secondary cardiovascular risk. So we have a test that measures your risk of an MI stroke in the next several years if you're over age 65, if you're a diabetic, or if you've had a previous event. So for those three groups. And we're already using this test, certainly in our work with the health systems utility trials that we have initiated. And I know, I'm guessing that some of your members have done this as well, because we know that some of our local physicians in the Colorado area here have told us they've used this test for the same purpose. That test alone, if you've got a patient, a diabetic, who's on, you know, one type of cardioprotective drug, and you get a test back that says, despite the fact that this patient's on this cardioprotective drug, their risk of an event is really high. And in that case, physicians are changing therapy to another drug or another class of drugs. So that's already being done. And you can think of that as a companion diagnostic.
Yep.
But we've also done some fairly, I would say, sophisticated research on the ability to not only direct people to a certain class of drugs, like I just mentioned, but also to tell you in the first few weeks of drug administration if that drug's going to work. We've actually published a couple of studies where we've looked at the proteomic expression profile of patients, you know, measuring thousands of proteins and looking for a pattern that predicts the ability to say, in this individual patient, this drug actually is not going to work. Or in some cases, even to say that this individual is more likely to have an adverse event related to this drug than others. And so when we think about companion diagnostics, we sort of think about it in two ways. One is the ability of these tests to encourage someone to change their therapeutic plan, to move someone off of, not just to direct them at a drug, but also to move them off of a drug to another one. And then also potentially to tell you in the first few weeks of drug administration, is this drug going to work? As you well know, in many contexts in medicine, you have a number of different drugs to choose from. Hypertension is a great example. You've got several classes of drugs, you know, beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, et cetera, et cetera. And there are some populations of patients where we know that this drug's most likely to be beneficial, but it's an imperfect science. And we should be able to have an impact on that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure some of our listeners are thinking back to how many different classes of drugs. I have to throw out the reserpine as an old treatment for hypertension from back in the day.
That's right.
One that we certainly don't use anymore. Well, one of the best ways that I think to understand how some of these proteomic tests can really benefit patient care is just to hear kind of a real world example, an actual case study. Do you have something in the oncology or something in cardiovascular risk or diabetes that you're able to share, obviously HIPAA compliant, but kind of a real world example of this being deployed?
Sure. I'll tell you my favorite story so far. I'm sure there'll be others over time. But
yeah.
So when we first started our demonstration market in Colorado, when we pushed out our first 10 tests to a handful of concierge practices in the Colorado region, the 11th patient that was tested, the physician for that patient called our physician liaison and said, "Hey, I was excited about using this new class of diagnostics, but I'm afraid they don't work." And she said, "Why is that?" And he said, "Well, I just tested this patient, and I've gotten this high primary cardiovascular risk result back." And a primary cardiovascular risk test is one that says, if you haven't had a previous event, if you're not 65, if you're not a diabetic, you know, sort of the average guy on the street, what's my risk of having an event? We know that as a backdrop to this case study, I was a cardiothoracic surgeon for 20 years, and I'm very well aware that about 10 to 15% of acute events occur in people that are thought to have no traditional risk factors. It's that, why is this patient in the ER with an MI statement that, you know, every internist and cardiologist has uttered at some point repeatedly in their careers.
Yeah.
So we get this call and he says, "I don't think your tests work." And he said, "This patient is a triathlete. He's normotensive. He has normal lipids. He has normal cholesterol. He doesn't smoke. He has an enviable diet, and he's my best friend." and so it wasn't just that, you know, I see this guy like, you know, once or twice a year.
Right.
And so he really knew this guy. And, you know, our physician liaison, I think, was probably stumped for a few seconds hearing that story. But then she sort of gathered herself up and said, "Hey, you may be right, but maybe you should get a calcium scan of his coronaries just as a screening, you know, test to see, just to make sure." And he's like, "Well, I don't think we really need to do that, but you've gotten him upset now with this result, so we might as well." And so they did the test, and he was off the chart. His calcium scan indicated that he had, you know, significant occult coronary vascular disease. And so this is potentially the power of proteomics. Again, I mentioned earlier, you know, it conceptually, this is going to sound really sophomoric, I know, but as I mentioned earlier, when you're doing a blood pressure cuff measurement, you know, when you're palpating a person's body in a physical exam, when you're looking at a CT scan, you're actually looking, feeling, and listening to what proteins are doing in the human body. And you're doing all these things in an indirect way. Admittedly, CT scans also have a little calcium, a little phosphorus, and some water. But almost everything else you're looking at is protein. So we've been doing these diagnostic maneuvers for 100 years with indirect measures of what proteins are doing in the body. And I don't think it should be shocking that at the number of proteins that we're measuring with the precision that we're measuring them at SomaLogic, that we're not getting these results, that we are basically, for the first time, really accessing the source code rather than looking at these things indirectly. So it's not, I don't think it should be shocking that we're uncovering risks that otherwise might be difficult to discern.
Yeah, no, that's a really powerful story. I think those closet cases that are, like you said, clearly this test is wrong and uncover, you know, patients with underlying disease, leave a very indelible mark on every physician's brain. But the other thing, I know that you guys do a fair amount of this, and it kind of brings back the real world evidence side. You do a lot of work with biobanks around the globe. Can you elaborate on some of the stuff that you do in that front?
Sure. So back in 2017, the company decided that at that time it was primarily just, you know, providing protein data to biomedical investigators and biopharma investigators for all their use cases. And of course, it's valuable information because we can measure, you know, 5,000 more proteins than any other organization at this point. But the founder's original goal was to actually harness the data from proteomics to create, an impactful set of diagnostics, the sort of thing that we're now doing. So back in 2017, we decided that we needed to collect more data, and put it into our own database so that we could begin to create these models that have resulted in those stories like that 11th patient.
Yeah.
And we started actually running around the world 5 years ago, contracting with, you know, a large number of biobanks around the world where we knew that the samples that had been collected were high quality, where we knew that the disease states we were interested in were represented in large numbers, where we knew that there was longitudinal clinical data that was high quality. Some of these biobanks had never actually allowed their samples to be assayed before. And we were able to tell them that, hey, listen, if you just give us 60 microliters of blood or serum or plasma, we'll give you back all these data points to put in your biobank for future uses, as long as we can have the data too for our uses. So we've done that. We now have a database of about 500,000 human samples, and about half of those have fully annotated clinical data. We continue to work with biobanks now for the same reason, to continue to put, you know, data into the database. For example, we're assaying a large biobank right now to help us create 4 tests over the next year that will predict your actual biologic risk of developing breast, prostate, lung, or colorectal cancer. And our preliminary models look really good on a small number of samples, and we've just broadened that into a much larger number of samples of the biobank where we know that oncologic diseases are highly represented. And of course, not to, you know, sort of veer over and talking about this class of tests, but you can imagine the potential impact of tests that actually quantify your biologic risk of developing cancer in the future. This isn't early diagnosis. This isn't a cell-free DNA, you know, test, you know, to see if there's a tiny tumor somewhere. This is to say, hey, Scott, you're at much higher than normal risk for colorectal cancer. You need to start having that screening done for cell-free DNA now, no matter what age you are, even if you're 35. You know, Chadwick Boseman, Black Panther, died of colorectal at 43. He wasn't getting colonoscopies. And then, of course, you might want to make some changes, right? So if you're a woman who's a smoker and overweight and has a high-fat diet, we tell them statistically your risk is probably higher than 1 in 8. But if we tell that woman that, hey, based on your own personal biology, your risk is 1 in 2, then might that individual be willing to make those changes herself, in addition to, you know, the clinician saying, let's put you into a more intensive screening program. So we use biobanks in this way. We also will be partnering with some biobanks over the next couple of years, even when we don't receive all the data, frankly, because we want proteomics data to be suffused into these large data pools for investigators around the world to use. We think that the value of this, exclusive of what we can do, is large. You know, when you can measure this many proteins with this much precision, and, you know, we want others to benefit from that information as well. So you'll see us making some announcements over the next year or two where we're partnering with other large biobanks around the world to do that job as well.
Excellent. I feel like I've gotten such a great education here on proteomics and exciting about what the future of this field holds. My guest has been CEO of SomaLogic, Dr. Roy Smyth. Roy, any closing remarks before we close out the episode here?
Well, first of all, thanks again for your time, and we've really appreciated the interest of your organization and what we're doing. Make no mistake, when I talk to the people at SomaLogic at the end of every town hall, when I talk to the board at the end of every board meeting, I always close by saying what we're really up to at SomaLogic. And so, you know, we just had some exciting news 2 weeks ago. We went public. We're now certainly paying attention to the creation of shareholder value as a public company. But make no mistake, we're here for a very specific reason. We're here to contribute to the relief of suffering and the prolongation of human life by putting new tools into the hands of clinicians around the world. And so, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about this, because maybe a few of those clinicians will be a bit more interested now in beginning to use these new tools.
Dr. Roy Smyth, CEO of SomaLogic, thank you so much for being an exceptional guest today. I hope you come back soon.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Roan Podcast. If you enjoyed your time here, be sure to subscribe. If you have a story you would like to share on the Roan Podcast, I encourage you to reach out. After all, we are stronger together. Now, I invite you to take a few for you and enjoy 3 minutes of relaxing audio. Be well, my friends.